Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thank you for listening. I am your host for today, one of your hosts, together with my co-host, Paul Wiersen. Hi, Paul.
Well, hello, Susan. And I've just had a great experience last week. Normally, I teach over at Colonesco, fifth graders. This is for the RSVP program. We have a speech program there where every child writes a three-minute speech, and there's a timekeeper and an MC. And normally, the class goes as always, but last week, they interrupted our class to say there was a speaker in the library, and all the fifth graders were to process in there. And I expected an adult with a very sharp PowerPoint presentation. And it was a very sharp PowerPoint presentation. But it was a sixth grader named Mia Steer. And I was so impressed, I had to have her on the show. Mia, are you there?
Yes.
Well, Mia, good morning, and it's good to hear from you. And you should tell us a little bit about why you were there. You're publishing books, isn't that right?
Yes, I published a book towards the end of third grade.
Oh, you began at third grade, right? Now when you're in sixth grade now, so you have, you're about 3 years of publishing under your belt, don't you? What was your first book about?
Toya the Drama Investigator, and it was about how to stay out of drama.
Oh, really? Really? Now, what Mia did last week was make a presentation on how to get a book published. How did you get started in this game, Mia?
Well, mostly entrepreneurship has been like something my parents have talked about, but writing a book was easy as a kid because you can't get a job when you're underage. So when you write a book, you get your money, and you can do it yourself and don't need somebody else's approval or anything like that.
Very good. So you published your first book in third grade. That means you were like 8 years old. And you published another book now. Is that right?
Not published it yet, but yeah, I'm working on it.
What's the new book? Well, give us a preview, okay? What is the new book?
So it doesn't have a title yet, but it's actually like a three-way book. We're having like three different perspectives on it. So me and my two friends are writing it, and we're each going to write a chapter so that the perspective ways of the people kind of change.
Really? Sounds fascinating. What's your target date? When are you going to have this book published?
Hopefully by the end of the summer.
Now, how often do you do a presentation like you did at Colonesco last week? Are you doing that pretty frequently?
So last month, which April, I set a goal of 101 classrooms to speak to. So that was pretty frequently, but I try and do it less frequently so I can still keep up with my schoolwork.
That's right. You're a working student, aren't you? You have to be in school every day. And you're a sixth grader, so how old are you now?
I'm 12 now.
You're 12, okay. And publishing your second book. Now, what you did in your presentation was tell the kids the various steps in getting a book published. And what are those steps? The first thing you need to do is what?
So there's like three steps. Before you write the book, it's while you're writing the book, and then it's after you're writing the book. Okay. They'll figure out the genre, fiction or nonfiction, more specific into what the book's going to be about. The second step to sum up would be like you're having your notes next to you and actually writing it. And then the third step would be like most of the hardest step is getting it published and getting your book cover done.
And how do you get it published? Your book is available on Amazon, is that correct?
Yes. So there are like three big ways. I use a self-publisher, which is bookpatch.com. I'm pretty sure, yeah. Bookpatch.com, and then you can also find a publisher, which I don't know how that works. Like, you send it to a bunch of people. Some of them deny, some of them like it, and then they take a percentage of what you sell. Mm-hmm. Same with Amazon, but like it doesn't deny or anything.
Well, that's pretty fantastic.
If you self-publish, like I did.
Wow.
If you self-publish, you can still put it on Amazon, though. So.
Well, you are a published author right now. And There are complications. Life isn't always smooth. And you were diagnosed with dyslexia, right?
Yes, I was diagnosed with dyslexia. In fourth grade, I was diagnosed by Apples of Gold. Because I have, so the biggest thing that affected me was my spelling. Because of that, though, I have, my memory is off the charts and stuff.
Okay, good. Off the charts. Hey, I think your whole program is off the charts. There aren't many 12-year-olds doing what you're doing. You're off the charts completely. So that seems to be a real barrier. How do you work around dyslexia? You just work with their memory? And tell me about that.
So at school I have accommodations like Google Read and Write. And it's pretty much for, you can talk to text and it'll just type what you say. One common thing about reading is that people mix up their words with dyslexia, which I still kind of do. So on the computer, there's, a thing you can use, so it's kind of, highlights what you're reading. But at school, I have accommodations.
It works out for you. But you're still a published author, and you've overcome the obstacle of dyslexia, and I credit you with that. That's taking on something that is very hard to do for most kids, to do publishing a book and writing a book. And if you have dyslexia, it's even more challenging.
I have a question about the dyslexia. I've known a number of people who had it, and they never explained much to me, but it sounds like it's much easier to deal with in the age of computers. I mean, since you can speak to the computer and have it write for you, is that true?
Yes, it's much easier in the world of computers, but also, because in fourth grade, ISAS was still took on ISAS, or now on computers, but they were on tests, and it was also you got the teachers to read to you. So it was also still having some teacher accommodations works, but yes, having a computer accommodations definitely does help in middle school world.
It's really nice to live in this era because not only do you have all this assistance with computers if you have dyslexia, but you also can publish. That's very dependent on the modern digital age too. And guess what? Mia is also involved in martial arts. Tell us about that, Mia.
So I'm in karate, which is Kenpo. Karate is a type that I do. It's focused on both foot and hand work. I'm a brown belt now, and I think I've been doing it for 2 years and a half.
Yeah, 2 years.
Brown belt.
What color belt do you wear?
Brown.
Brown.
Brown belt. That's good. So how often do you do karate every week?
Two times a week. Well, it depends on the week. Usually I'll come two or three times a week. But I can also come four times a week if I want.
What's the next step up from brown?
Second brown.
Second brown. Well, is that going to be something you do pretty quickly here? Is it right? Are you right on the cusp?
We just took a belt exam, but I didn't break my board, so I failed. So that'll be in 3 months.
Well, I hope you can come to my farm and break boards as long as you want. But I'll tell you one thing.
Okay.
I'm really impressed that you are, A, doing all your schoolwork, B, you're publishing books, C, you are accomplished in the martial arts and karate and up to a brown belt. And I don't think there's anything that Mia Steer can't do. As a matter of fact, I think you should take your parents shopping. What you need to buy is a cape, because in my book, you're Supergirl, okay? Mia, it's just been delightful to have you. Good luck, and you can get the book on Amazon. What's the book title of the first one you wrote?
Victoria the Drama Investigator.
Wow, sounds intriguing, like a real page-turner. Thank you. Mia Steers, sixth grader. She's at the Dallas Center Grimes School District, and she's fully employed as a published author, karate expert, and, of course, she goes to school every day. Thanks, Mia Steer.
Thank you.
In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we have been hearing from Mia Steer telling us how to publish a book. Mia is a sixth grader from Dallas Center, Grimes, who has published several of her own books and came to Colonesco in hope of inspiring students here. This is a great way to end the school year and give students ideas about writing through the summer. But it's May Day today, the 1st of May, when thoughts of growing things and agriculture are foremost in our minds, especially in Iowa. So it's time that our new farm reporter, Gina McAndrews, is here. You have some guests today, don't you, Gina?
Good day, Susan. This is Gina. Yes, we have, speaking of publishers, we have Mary Swander, who's been well published in the world. Yes. She was Iowa State Poet Laureate, and she's currently living in Kelowna, Iowa, and she has an ag arts program and many other programs and activities she has going on. I think we have Mary on there. One thing we're going to talk about is her map of my kingdom. Mary, are you on there?
I'm here.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you, Gina?
Good. Can you tell us a little bit about ag arts and map my kingdom?
Sure. Ag arts actually started there and aimed at Iowa State, and Fred Kirschenman and I put our heads together, and we wanted to form an organization that imagines and promotes healthy food systems through the arts. And then I left Iowa State, took the organization with me, made it a bigger deal, and it's a 501(c) now, and we're doing anything we can to, you know, look at the intersection of arts and agriculture. And so right now we're focusing on farm-to-artist residencies. So we put artists on farms for 2 weeks to 2 months, and they get to know the farmer, and then they reflect or explore the issues that the farmer has in their work. And these can be visual artists, writers, theater artists, you know, a whole dancers, a whole array of people. And I have, right now, I have three or four farms involved. And I have artists who are clamoring to be on the farms. And so we're trying to raise some money, get some donations to keep this happening. Now, the other enterprise I've got going is Wonder Woman Productions, which is a theater troupe that we do plays about agriculture. So that actually started again in Ames with a class that I had. We wrote a play called Farmscape about the changing rural environment, and then the whole thing just took off, and I did a play called Vang about immigrant farmers, which is touring, and then Map of My Kingdom was commissioned by Practical Farmers of Iowa about farmland succession, and that's been very, very popular. It's a huge issue. We've toured these plays coast to coast, and now we're working on a piece called Farm to Fork Tales, where we get farmers to tell their own stories up on the stage and create a sense of history about agriculture.
Wow, it sounds like you've really been busy.
Yeah. You can find more information about these things on the websites. Ag Arts is agarts.org.
Okay.
And the theater troupe is Mary Swander, SWANDER.com. And so there's a lot more information and list of events where we'll be, where, when, why. This thing has just exploded, Gina. The last semester here, from the 1st of February through the 1st of May, we had 30 performances all over the country.
Wow, that's terrific. Is that of Map of My Kingdom?
Map of My Kingdom and Vang and Farm to Fork Tales, all three of them.
Are any of them coming up here in central Iowa in the next month or so?
We'll be doing, we'll be doing a show in Radcliffe, just north of Ames. That's June 2nd, and that's Map of My Kingdom. That'll be at the Radcliffe Community Center. And we're doing May 18th, I believe that is. I have to check on that date. And that's in Des Moines, and that's for the Asian Heritage Month. And the time and place is on my website.
Okay, well, we'll post the websites on ours on our website when we post the program later today or tomorrow.
Can you tell us a little more about the Map of My Kingdom and the focus of that?
Sure. This is about 5 years ago. Teresa Ofeim, who is the executive director of Practical Farmers of Iowa, called me into her office. It was always like being called into the principal's office or something. I thought, oh, what did I do wrong now? And but it was all good. She asked me to write a play about farmland succession, who's going to get the farm next. And she said she took a survey of her farmers, and it was one of the top concerns. It's a huge issue. It doesn't matter what period you're living through. And I knew this from having seen four generations of farmers in my own family deal with this issue. And if you deal with it early and thoughtfully in a well-planned way, it can work out very well. But if you wait and put it off and don't check all your options, it can be, something that blows up a whole family. Even if you plan well, it can blow up a family, I well know. And so I sat there and thought, oh, wow, this is a huge issue and opportunity. So she sent me off hither and yon around the state, and I interviewed various farmers, bankers, insurance people involved with the topic. But I really didn't have to go hither and yon. But I would basically be walking down the street. People would say, what are you working on now? And I'd say, farmland succession, and everybody has a story about it. I mean, oh, listen to what happened in my family. So we get it up on its feet. It's a one-woman show. And we've toured. We've had over 120 performances. We originally thought we would have four in the four quadrants of Iowa, and now we've been coast to coast with it. We also have a video that you can purchase through my website. And that's a really helpful tool because families buy that and they watch the video together and then they begin their discussion. It's really hard to even open up the discussion in a family of farmland succession for many reasons. And this is a great vehicle to start that dialogue and move forward with it. And, what I've discovered that there are really functional families who do work through this process very well. And one of the things that Practical Farmers set up was a seminar, a workshop to write a legacy letter to your future generations of your vision for your land. And the first step is to figure out what your values are for the land. Do you want it to remain a functional family farm? Do you want one of your family members to be farming it? Is your first value conservation? Is it family harmony? Mm-hmm. Is it to make money, to sell it and make money? And once you sift that out and sort through what the possible motives are for you to create a farmland succession plan, then things become much more clear, and you can move forward with that. So, I've been doing those workshops too, and those have been very valuable. Just got back not too long ago from Lake Okoboji. We did a workshop there, and beautiful site at Lakeside Labs, looking over the lakes. And we had about 60 people there, and lots of interest. Whole families come to this, to the workshop, and that's another way that they get going on their plan. And sometimes they come to the workshop, sit down, and they've never discussed a word of this to each other. Sometimes they come to the workshop and they've all been fighting for several years over
it. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
I can understand how that can happen.
Yep, and it helps them, you know, get something on paper and concrete and move through their situation. A lot of them, you know, the main character in Map of My Kingdom is a mediator, farmland succession mediator, and a lot of them need that. I mean, it's really funny, different parts of the country handle this in different ways. This winter we were in Oregon, and they have, working with the extension program, they have a whole, you know, program set up for people, and the PowerPoint, and da-da-da-da, and the lawyer extension agent got up and said, okay, your first stop, very first thing that you should all do is go to the therapist. and I thought, well, all right, that's the way they handle it on the West Coast. So we're making progress on it.
And we had a real big event here on March 10th.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? We had a kind of a combination of events.
Yeah, we did. It was great. Mark Gannon, who is the director of the Family Farm Heritage Foundation, wants to and is in the process of collecting farming stories and oral histories. It's really a great project. And he's focusing on century farms, but he's basically interested in any history of a farm. And so we put our heads together, and I said, well, you know, let's make a fun project out of it. Let's get the farmers up on their feet telling stories. We'll make a performance of it and get people there and get some momentum going. And so we did. We had four farmers. It was great. And we have I have a storytelling coach who works with them on the phone in advance of the performance. And then we had Dave and Mary Lozier, who are old-time musicians, and they provided some music before and after the show in between the stories. We heard stories from people in their 90s who had grown up on their farm. It was great. And then we heard a wonderful story by Gina McAndrews about her century farm that she grew up in northwest Iowa. And then we had some vendors, people that had CSAs, farms, different organizations. We had some tabling. And so they were there, and the audience could see local people selling local food. And it was packed. It was a great event. And we videotaped the storytellers, and Mark's going to post those to his website. And so I've been booking this Farm to Fork Tales around the state, and it's kind of, we'll be doing a similar thing in different towns, and each town will have its own focus. And then what I hope to do is make a podcast of the storytelling themselves, and hint, hint, maybe we can get KHOI to play that podcast in the future.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Well, yeah.
I can see what I can get to work on that.
All right. I've been studying up how to make podcasts. It's not that hard. And
so maybe we could, in combination, then have those stories we could put onto Mark Gannon's website.
Exactly. Put them on Mark Gannon's website. We'll have the event, but it'll also help distribute the stories so that more people will enjoy them, reach a larger audience.
Okay, I'm getting the signal that we need to go to our next event.
Well, Mark Gannon is going to be talking to us in just a few minutes, just to have a quick music break while we get him on the phone. Thanks so much, Mary.
You bet. Thanks for calling.
And are we hoping to do this again next year?
Oh, that would be great.
All right. Well, we'll keep you posted.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
On Saturday night, when our work is done, we load our music up on the run. Heavy traffic ahead. Heavy traffic ahead. We got a rebel, rebel. There's heavy traffic ahead. ride to Nashville right on time. The Bluegrass Special heads down the line. Heavy traffic ahead. Heavy traffic ahead. We gotta ramble, ramble. There's heavy traffic ahead. Travel around from state to state. The Bluegrass Boys are never late. Heavy traffic ahead. Heavy traffic ahead.
Good morning, Mark. How are you today?
How are you? Very good. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, thank you. Just wanted to let folks know we have Mark Gannon with Real Estate and does farmland management, but also he started this great foundation called the Family Farm History Foundation. And Mark, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it goes back, I guess, quite a ways, 20 years, but in 2013, we started a foundation to preserve family farm histories. We felt that was important. There really wasn't a good format to do that, kind of an online system. We're just getting to the point of making this live, and we have our kickoff here not too long down the road. We did take some time and scanned and helped the Department of Agriculture scan all the Century Farm files from the state. They were in a paper form at the Department of Agriculture. Now those are all online and those are available to people. We thought that was an important start for what we're trying to do. And even though we're not tied in with the Century Farm program, that's a lot of good history. But essentially it's going to be available for anybody to save anything they want on an online form and have it there forever for their family and for their friends or anybody that any historians or anybody that wants to know this stuff later on.
Well, that sounds really valuable. And immediately I thought, is that available to anybody online? Could we put a link on our website and could people go to that?
Yeah, we're not quite ready yet. We've kind of gone through some stops and starts as far as what we're doing, how much we're going to do and how much we're going to do and not going to do. And it's always been kind of a debate. But anyway, we've got a plan, and I think Jean is there with you, and she knows a little bit of that. But we're going to roll out a version here probably within 30 days, and then make an announcement. But we'll keep you guys informed. We've done some good stuff so far, but haven't been real visible yet. But we're about to be there.
But kind of one of the goals, I think, Mark, is to get people to tell their stories about their farm, their area, and connections with their land and their farm, and for individuals to be able to put that on a website and record that form. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it's a big part of it. We need to capture people's stories, their voices, their emotions. We've done some already, and, you know, kind of the normal story is those people don't think they got anything to add, and when it turns out they got a lot to add, and it's valuable stuff to keep for their family members and somebody to know their grandfather, their grandmother's voice, and some stories that they want to keep for their family. And, you know, there's been numerous people that have said, boy, I wish I would have done that with, you know, name somebody, grandmother, grandma, my dad, my mom. But now it's time, we're going to have a forum to be able to do that and make that available to people.
I went on your website, Mark, and I saw a little bit about your business. You're also a farm manager, and it sounds like that you help people, particularly young farmers, have a chance to start, for example, cover crops. This doesn't work if you're renting by the year, I have been told. So could you tell a little about what you try to do in your business?
Well, yeah, in managing farms, we just try to do the best thing we can for that piece of land. And, you know, whether that's fertility, whether that's yield, whether that's cover crops, the biggest thing is to preserve the land, and that's kind of where the history ties in, too. That's another part of preservation of that piece of property. But we've got to keep the land as productive as possible, and and fix things that are wrong. You mentioned cover crops. I mean, I think cover crops is a good thing. It's hard to get, especially on rented farms, to get people to do those on a short-term basis. Really, cover crops are good when they're done year after year after year. I'm not sure we'll ever get enough cover crops to solve our problems, but it's a good start, and it's a good thing. But it's also, you know, some farmers have tried them and don't like them, and it's hard to convince them to do it. On a rental basis, it's hard to force somebody to do it, even though we've probably had half a dozen farms do cover crops last year. Last fall was not a good year for cover crops, but there's a lot of other things to do, and it all eventually goes back to water quality. If you do things right on the farm, your water ought to be in a lot better shape than, you know, sometimes, you know, what people do.
Well, the reason I asked that question was I had an interview a year ago or so with Aaron Lehman and a young farmer he'd been working with. And the young farmer said that he wished that it was possible to get to rent land for 3 years, because 1 year you have to get as much money out of the land as possible right away. And if that means, you know, putting on extra fertilizers and so forth, you do it. But you can take care of the land better if you have time to develop that.
Yeah, and that's what we try to do, is get sustainable leases that are – we use a lot of flex leases, which means the rent will vary with the yield and the prices. And hopefully those are long-term, you know, as long as possible. We try to stay away from just annual cash rents, even though you can't avoid it in some of the cases. But the longer-term leases, you know, as long as the farm produces well, then the rent should be appropriate, and that's what we shoot for.
Well, thank you.
You bet. And beginning farmers, we'd like to do more with that. That's kind of a harder nut to crack, but you know, there's some significant tax credits for doing that, and some older owners especially, and that's, we have a lot of those, you know, don't necessarily want to take a chance. They just want to rent it out, and it, you know, it's a little more work to deal with somebody that's younger and maybe has a little more need.
That's definitely understandable. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for joining us today, and we'll have you back on again when we get that website ready to go and can get a little more activity going.
Hey, this is
KHOI. I appreciate it.
This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area. KHOI's farm reporter, Gina McAndrews, has been talking with Mary Swander about her play, The Map of the Kingdom, Our Map of My Kingdom, and with Mark Gannon, who works with farmers who are transitioning from full-time farming to other forms of farm management. And for the next few minutes, we'd like to play some stories from farmers about the way farming used to be on their century farms. And by the way, I grew up on a century farm, and my grandfather emigrated from Norway. Our farm was purchased in 1903, and my father, his son, began farming there with horses in 1930. And so I had my career in Des Moines and moved back to the family farm to retire, and I'm sure glad I did. And I remember growing up where we had all kinds of animals, chickens, hogs, cattle, sheep, all that, two horses too. And we did a lot of small plot farming, you know, alfalfa. We had alfalfa, oats, corn, beans, rotated crops. You could raise a family on 160 acres, and I cherish that background, and I know you do too, Gina.
Yes, I sure do. And it was sure fun to have this event with the Family Farm History Foundation and the Ag Arts Map My Kingdom program that we had on March 10th at the Ames Public Library. I think Susan picked out a couple stories from there.
Yes, I did. So the first one is from Gordon Bivens. And it's clearly a story of a century farm.
The spring of 1933, I moved there when I was six. And it was a farm that my grandfather had purchased in 1902. he had never lived on it, but owned it and operated it, and with hired help. So we moved there in 1933, and I went into first grade in Fernald High School. This is northeast of Nevada, and there was no central heat. And so we lived without those conveniences that we take for granted today. That meant that there was no bathroom. And that in the winter time, taking care of one's necessities was a chilling experience. and really leave the rest to your imagination. But living room in our house, first of all, it was an old house. It didn't have insulation. It wasn't particularly well built. And so the wind would penetrate mightily in the winter. And the living room had a 9x12 rug, which we thought was kind of grand. And it had a potbelly stove in the middle. The potbelly stove was the only thing that held the rug down when the wind blew. So I don't know how many of you can claim to have lived on a flying carpet, but I have. I have. One way of thinking, anyway. My brother and I slept in an upstairs bedroom that was, it was so cold. There was no heat other than what came through a little register that went through the floor of the bedroom into the ceiling of the living room, and so a little bit of the heat from the potbelly stove came up, but not enough to make much difference. And so we would get up in the morning, grab our clothes, and race downstairs and dress beside another stove in the dining room that my dad had fired up and got red hot. It was a steel sided stove, and the sides of the stove would literally get red hot. And we would dress by that, and I've often thought, what would have happened if we had fallen against that red hot stove? But it didn't happen, thank goodness. Well, my dad worked for my grandfather as a hired man, the lead hired man. And I say lead because we also had another man that was a hired man. And he lived with us and took his meals with us. He was a member of our family, basically. Nice fellow, Bruce Sutherland. We all loved Bruce. But the two men, my father and Bruce, operated the farm on behalf of my grandfather. One of my jobs early on was to bring in cobs to put into the range, the kitchen range, and to help Dad build that hot fire in the steel-sided stove. When we would shell corn, we would put a stash of cobs in a little house, cob house we called it. And not very imaginative, is it? Well, at any rate, the cob house was... Now, that meant an awful lot of stogies, and I haven't quite figured out how they handled that, but it doesn't matter. Now, Saturday nights were a big deal. I don't know if anyone else in this room remembers that Saturday night was such a big deal. Big deal in that farm families would take cream and eggs into town and sell them at the creamery, get money there, and go to the grocery store and buy a week's supply of groceries. And then, if you were lucky, have a parking place on Main Street where you could sit and talk with neighbors as they would amble up and down the street. It was a social occasion. And it was so important that, in fact, that my aunt, who lived in town, would go up and plant a car on Main Street so that we were sure to have our congregating spot. And my family would then camp out in their car, and other people would come by, talk and gossip, I'm afraid. And that was the evening. My good friend, my very best friend, Wendell Johnson, and I were 8, 9, 10 years old. We would walk up and down Main Street, 2 blocks long, and we would just go kind of up and around. I don't know, I think we were just cruising. And sometimes we would meet stop at the Ford dealership at the south end of the cruise, or the Chrysler dealership at the north end, and we would sit in a new car on the floor there, the showing floor. That was really special because we didn't have a new car. Well, my grandpa did occasionally, but we never did have a new car, so that was really something, and boy, did it smell good. On the way home, after all the socializing, get in the car and start out and go by the ice house in the south part of town, and we would pick up 50 pounds of ice. Remember, no electricity. So we had an ice box, and we would get our 50-pound block of ice, put it on the bumper so that it didn't drip and mess up the car inside, and it would drip outside, go home, put the ice in the refrigerator, in the ice box, and that was the way we got things, took care of things. It was okay. I mean, you know, but it was different. After we got home, if there had been enough money left after buying the groceries, if there was enough money left to buy a copy of the Register, Sunday Register, which was out on Saturday night, my folks would. And my brother and I would then go to sleep, sweating, usually if it was summertime, and reading the funnies. Occasionally, well, in fact, really fairly often, my brother Mark and I would be left at my grandparents' in town on Saturday night. If we didn't do what I just described, we'd be left in town with my grandparents. And that was for two reasons. We would have a bath in the tub with hot running water. Pretty special. And we would be there in time for Sunday school on Sunday morning, for sure. No matter what the weather. So that often happened too. The farm was also the place where the family gathered on holidays, and especially like 4th of July. And that was special because my grandpa would bring a whole case of pop. Wow, was that special. Not the big bottles that we know now, more modest bottles of pop. Oh boy, we had a good time there. And we would freeze ice cream, you know, again, this way. And that was very special, tasty. In the evening, we'd have sparklers. If someone was daring enough and had enough money, we might even have a few firecrackers. And in the afternoon, I forgot, we croquet. Now, I don't know how many people have played croquet, but it's a pretty nice game, and we enjoyed playing that. These gatherings of holidays like that would be in the yard of the farmhouse, or across the creek, up on the hill, where there was a beautiful setting within the woods, and looking out over East Indian Creek. This was a very special picnic spot that we had and used quite often. Life, in terms of things we would compare it with today, sound a little bit tough, perhaps. But that was softened by the we're in, we're all in it together feeling that there was between generations. And the closeness of generations gave a warm and reassuring feeling to everyone, I think. I know it did to me. And I'm pleased that our connection continues. Our oldest son, who's here today, still lives on the farm. And that makes me feel connected to it, too.
The second story is about an Iowa farm girl who goes to Australia.
So I had an interview. I was down in Queensland, Australia. On the other end of the phone was a few questions. Well, can you ride a horse? Yep. Do you ever castrate a bull? Yep. Can you drive a tractor? Yep. How about a motorcycle? Yep. All right then, well I guess we'll hire you. I never hired a girl before, but we'll pick you up from the bus. So that was my interview for a cattle and sheep station position down in Queensland, Australia. I got back to where I was staying in Townsville. Professor I was staying with, she said, "How'd you learn to do all those things?" That's what really got me reminiscing about growing up on my family's century farms. My dad had bought both my grandparents, his grandparents' farms. And, of course, in Dubuque County, everybody has lots of kids, and a lot of people stayed around there. And so I was lucky enough to grow up knowing my grandparents and great-grandparents, and all my relatives lived nearby. But I was the oldest, and I always loved to go with Dad, and he got me a horse when I was 2. And just kind of put me up there and let me go. It wasn't a whole lot of training, and that was kind of the beginning of life on the farm. So I was driving when I was about 5 or 6. He just put me in the truck, and I'd peek out over the end, because we were just driving to the next field, so he didn't want to walk back and get the tractor. So I just drive along because he figured all I'd hit is him. So I grew up like Dad, and we used to, you know, I'd imitate Dad driving down the roads. Because back then they didn't have the GPS, so we had to drive around and check out all the neighbors' cornfields. Oh, see, they didn't plant very straight. They probably fell asleep down there. We go down to the local coffee shop and talk to all the farmers. And so I really learned a lot and how to talk to people and all that sort of thing. And then one April, I used to always leave my dad notes because I loved to go with him. So I'd make sure he'd wake me up in the morning, and so he'd wake me up in the morning. This one April morning, on Sunday, we were going to go disc a little before church. And so he was letting me drive the tractor. And I was going along, and of course, I wasn't really doing much, but I thought I was really doing good. Anyway, we were getting to a little rocky ground, and he says, "Well, why don't you sit over here?" He said, "I better drive because, you know, getting to Shamrock, I might have to stop." So, of course, I'm sitting over there, just gawking around. And lo and behold, we went a little farther, had to stop. I went flying off. He reached down to grab me, and his foot came off the clutch and ran me over. Had a 40-20. Luckily, it had dual tires, so it wasn't quite. Anyway, then he backed up, and I guess I flew against the front wheel. So, of course, he jumped down and picked me up and saw I was alive. And I was conscious through the whole thing, so I guess I was in shock. But he says, "Well, do you think I should take you home or to the hospital?" And I know for sure that was the only time I ever said that. "I think you better take me to the doctor." So he ran, got the truck, and lo and behold, we didn't stop at any stoplights all the way to town. And anyway, got to the hospital. They come out with the wheelchair and all the gear, haul me in, put me on the table. And this nurse came with these big shears, like you trim sheep with. And I started screaming because I was like, "Dad, they're going to cut my brand new pants." Because these were my brand new go to the farm pants that my dad just bought me. Anyway, he just told me to shut up and he gave me another pair of pants. So next thing I knew, I woke up in intensive care. And I was in traction with pins in my leg. Anyway, it was a long process. I was up in the hospital a couple months. And my dad taught me how to play poker, so I wasn't too bored. So I was making nickels and dimes off some of my visitors and make bets on the basketball games. Then one of my neighbor friends, he got in the farm accident too, got cut his kneecap off. And he was up there, so by then I was in a wheelchair, so we got in trouble a couple of times. We'd go out in the parking lot, we'd have wheelchair races. But anyway, a year later I was back at home, and by then I learned to drive the straight truck, and so I was hauling corn and silage, and just really always enjoyed riding horses. And we had cows and calves, and the pigs were always snorting up the ground in the pasture. And went on teaching 4-H, and I remember growing up, just to reflect a little bit back on farms, that some of the neighboring farms were lost. And I'd always ask Dad, because he'd let me stay home from school, like to fix fence. I thought that was like the coolest thing. Well, you know, Joe, he didn't teach his 2 sons to how to take care of the farm, let them help manage it. And so he died, and I mean, 40 and 50-year-olds didn't know how to run the farm. So consequently, Dad, I was combining and cultivating in high school. So there was other 40-year-old neighbors who wouldn't, their dads wouldn't let them combine or And so I really learned a lot. I was in 4-H and showed cattle and sheep and just about everything. And just the whole love of agriculture. I went on to Iowa State thinking I was going to go into veterinary school. And anyway, I was having a lot of fun, and organic chemistry didn't quite agree with me too often. I quickly realized that was going to require more time and effort than the judging team and the rodeo team and all the other things I was doing. I also was working at a local farms around Ames and combining and cultivating. They're like, they just couldn't believe I knew how to do that sort of thing. Because even one of the farmers I worked for, his 30-year-old son, he hadn't taught to run the combine yet. And I was like, well, I know how to do that. So he didn't believe me, so he just let me combine. I said, well, I guess you do. But from there, after I graduated, I had the opportunity to work in Washington, D.C. with the Senate. And so really loved working for the Senate, and I got the opportunity to work on ag policy, environmental policy, and really got a different perspective from an international interest. And so then I bought an around-the-world ticket and used those farm skills again as I left the $400. So I had to get jobs along the way. So I was always milking cows or driving tractors and trucks and various sorts of things. And anyway, by the time I got back to Australia, I always wanted to work at a cattle and sheep property. And so I worked there for 3 or 4 months. I had that job and actually had to got to have my parents come visit. So it was winter here, and it was 40 degrees or over 100 degrees Celsius when they came over there and saw the ranch. But anyway, after that, I came back to college and ended up teaching at Iowa State in agronomy. So I continued that interest in food issues and agriculture. And all through graduate school, I mean, I used a lot of those determination and skills. But meanwhile, my parents, the 80s caught up with us in the 90s, and so we lost both Century Farms. And it was really a tough time. And, you know, a lot of emotions and connections to the land and the memories and just the generations of people that have come from Ireland and they settled in Dubuque County, and now there's somebody else there. And but at the same time, I think back, you know, from that time in Australia and just being here today. You know, where growing up on a farm, it's hard to imagine not growing up on a farm. Just all the skills, problem solving. And I'm sure all of you as well, you just go get the cows. You didn't get directions on how to ride a horse, just get on and figure it out. And so a lot of those things, you build confidence in just meeting people and going to try things out. And so I'm real thankful for, you know, having the opportunity. And I sure am trying in my own ways, being on different boards and that sort of thing, to help continue the legacy of kids being able to grow up on farms. And that the farms are still around, and kids are getting able to learn, you know their grandparents and hear these wonderful stories that, you know, every day they're being lost. And I hear a lot of times people are, their kids live in faraway places and they only see them once a year. And it's just hard to hear because there's so much you learn from not only farms but from our older folks and our. Now that I'm getting to be one, here I am rambling on. Anyway, so it just reflects back to my job in Australia and everything I learned on the farm is still continuing to benefit me today.
Well, Susan, let's end the show today with a preview of some music coming to the stages in our listening area. First, I'd like to let people know that the bluegrass band Monroe Crossing will be at the Story City Opera House May 9th, 7 p.m. That's a Thursday night. Monroe Crossing at the Opera House in Story City.
You've heard one of their songs during breaks earlier in the show, so I'd like to play a selection from the outstanding vocal group that will be coming to the Talent Factory in Nevada this Saturday, May 4th at 7 p.m. This is the Grammy Award-winning a cappella group Tonic Sol Fa. They were even part of Garrison Keillor's 30th anniversary celebration of Prairie Home Companion.
And hey, last week we had a band that played on Prairie Home Companion right here at the Pantorium. It was the Barn Owl Band.
That's right, and Tonic Sol Fa could hardly be more different from the Barn Owl Band. Let's hear them sing just a little bit of Just One of Those Days.
Those days. find a parking space. Everybody's waiting on you to arrive. You don't want to lie, so you tell them it's just one of those days.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts for today, Susan Franz and Paul Wearson, and our new farm reporter, Gina McAndrews. We spoke with Mia Steer, Mary Swander, Mark Gannon, and Gordon Bivens.
You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org.
Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Molly Tenbrook's from CD Monroe Crossing plays the music of Bill Monroe. And Just One of Those Days by Tony Sylvanus from their CD Just One of Those Days.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. Now, that's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as a listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening and
see you again on the radio.